Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Travis Tippins of The Fantasy Inn, and we are going to be discussing The Calculating Stars by Mary Robinette Cole, which won the 2019 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Travis, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Seth. I'm excited to be here.
It's a pleasure. So why don't you tell my listeners a little about yourself?
Okay, sure. So I'm one of the reviewers over at the Fantasy Inn blog, which, as the name suggests, mostly covers fantasy books. Mm-hmm. I also run the Fantasy Inn podcast, which alternates between discussions on a particular speculative fiction topic and long-form interviews with authors, podcasters, editors, pretty much anyone in the broader industry. Try to stay away from just writers, just so we can get a little bit of variety.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's me.
Cool. Well, what about some of your kind of history as a science fiction / fantasy fan?
Yeah. So I think I've had a lot of conversations about this before with people, and I think I kind of agree with the idea that a lot of people kind of start out as sort of science fiction and fantasy fans, just because the really young books targeted at kids have a lot of fantastical stuff in them. Mm-hmm. So I'd say I've probably always been one. Used to read roughly 50-50 kind of science fiction and fantasy, but eventually when I was browsing through the library for hours on end, I'd kind of gravitate more towards the covers of like the warriors with swords on the cover rather than spaceships.
Gotcha.
But I've read through like early loves were the Enderverse, Animorphs, Ben Bova's Planets books, as well as on the fantasy side, like Redwall, David Eddings, The Forgotten Realms. So basically anything and everything I could pick up.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I kind of stopped reading a lot in high school and college until I found an online fantasy forum on reddit.com. Mm. And so that kind of kicked me more in the fantasy direction.
Cool. Well, talking about science fiction and fantasy and Hugo Awards, did you happen to tally up how many of the Hugo winners you've read?
Yes. So it's not a very impressive number. I've only read 10.
Okay.
And I think about half of those were the rare fantasy books that occasionally win the Hugo, because I know it's mostly science fiction.
It is. Yeah. At this point, this segment of my podcast, I'm starting to get like, well, you know, I'm at 48 now. And so it's starting to feel like bragging, where in the early going, it was just, see, I'm making progress. I'm up to 14, you know?
Yeah. Well, I will say I've DNF'd or picked up and then put down about partway through a good 10 or so other of the Hugo winners.
Okay.
Just because mostly I've found that on the older end of the books, a lot of them kind of don't mesh with me as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and, you know, not everybody is the type of person who is going to pull the plug on a book, right? A lot of times, even in my past, I've done it where, hey, it's kind of the sunk cost fallacy of reading, where you're like, hey, I've read 2/3 of this book. I have to push through. I have to finish it. And I almost always regret it when I do.
Oh, absolutely. And I even still do that occasionally, even with like long running series. So, I mean, maybe there's like 15 books in a series and I'll be on book 4 and I'm like, well, I just got to keep going. I'm already 20% of the way in.
Right. Yeah. So why this book in particular, though, Travis?
I think I first heard about it. I'm a big fan of the Writing Excuses podcast, and Mary Robinette Cole is one of the hosts, or one of the main hosts. I know they rotate a lot now. So I heard a lot of talk about the book as she was writing it and as she was researching it. Hmm. And I'd been meaning to try her books for a while, but once I heard her interview with like an actual astronaut to get some of the technical jargon and the actual emotions that you might feel in that cockpit, right? That sold me on this book in particular, I think. And it also probably helped that the book was getting a lot of love at the time in the blogger circles I was hanging out in. So the fear of missing out and relentless peer pressure were pretty good motivators.
Yeah. So at this point, I mean, you know, this is a book written by a woman with a female protagonist. You know, it definitely increases kind of the representation in science fiction. And so I just want to talk about the elephant in the room of two dudes talking about this book. And I mean, it's kind of the typical science fiction podcast experience that you'll get, right, from a couple guys talking about the book. But I also want to emphasize, you know, just because the book is written by a woman and features a female protagonist does not mean it can't be enjoyed by everybody. And so if you do want to hear from some women on this, I totally get that. And I will recommend and endorse Hugo Girl. They did an episode on this book recently, and you know, they're tremendous. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes so people want to get that perspective as well. So how about we dive into our non-spoiler discussion of this book? Though this one, it's, I don't know, it's not that vulnerable to spoilers, but can you give a quick synopsis of the book?
Sure. So The Calculating Stars is an alternate history set, at least for the first book, in the 1950s, where a meteorite strikes off the eastern coast of the United States, and then a math genius and former WASP pilot, Alma York, has to calculate how to get humanity off the planet, basically, because they find that the resulting climate change will send humans the way of the dinosaurs within around 50 or so years. So thus begins the effort to colonize space.
Nice. That's perfect. And along the way, you know, she has aspirations to actually go into space.
Yes, hence the Lady Astronaut title of the series.
Right, yeah, which I saw an interview with Mary Robinette, and she said that, you know, that's kind of a spoiler right there about the direction that the series is going to take. Out of curiosity, have you read The Lady Astronaut of Mars, the short story?
I have not. Have you?
Okay. I have, yeah. It's pretty brief. You can read it for free on Tor.com. And it's a good story, and it's actually a Hugo winner for short story. And it's set some time in the future. So the Calculating Stars and the rest of the series is a prequel to it.
Right. And I think you did have an interesting point, since we're on the non-spoiler portion of the chat, that this is kind of a tough book to spoil, in the sense that I don't think you could tell me any individual plot point and I would be like, ah, the book is ruined. It's more about kind of the steps along the way and the character interactions and those sorts of struggles.
Yeah. Well, how about we move then into kind of overall thoughts? Did you enjoy this one?
I did. Yeah. I really love this book, and this was actually a reread for me.
Oh, nice.
Or I guess you could probably say a re-listen, because in general, I think one of the main things that I love about this book is you have a Hugo award-winning author who is also a professional audiobook narrator who is narrating her own story, which I don't think that's ever happened before. there's a very small pool of people who could pull that off, and I think it might be a pool of one, actually. And so I think that really adds an extra element to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's cool. I'll have to check out the audiobook. Maybe when I get around to future books in the series, I might retake this one in on audio. She's a great follow on social media, and she posts some really cool content there. Recently, she did interpretive reading of a series of tweets that she did about the space program and fun facts about astronauts and, you know, diapers and that kind of stuff, body functions and space.
Yeah, she has a lot of interesting content, especially like anytime there's any kind of significant space launch or rocket going off, or like an EVA from the space station. She's always very interesting to follow her live tweets of all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. I really enjoyed this one as well. It's very easy to read. I slacked off on this one and didn't get much reading in, and pretty much read it over the last 4 days without really stressing about it. And that's always really nice when the prose is easy to read. The book is fun and enjoyable. It has kind of a hard sci-fi edge to it without being a slog. And, you know, she talks about when you read this book, before you start nitpicking on anything that she did in the book, you need to read the historical note, because she did take some liberties, but she was, you know, she wants to be completely upfront about that. And, I like the alternate history angle. I like the sort of hard science fiction, and, I like the fact that even in the alternate history, you know, set in the 50s, it's got people in it, and people are still people and therefore still suck. some good social commentary. I really appreciated that kind of stuff. So if you wanted to recommend this novel, can you think of any comps or, in media, books, movies, anything?
Sure. So I guess the obvious ones that come to mind for me are movies. So it feels a bit like a mashup between meteor movies like Armageddon or Deep Impact and Hidden Figures, where you have all the people behind the scenes, the women computers who are kind of running the rocket program. And I think in general, maybe fans of science fiction, like you said, it does have a hard element to it. But I think that focuses more on the human side of things rather than the specific advances in technology. We'll find a lot to love.
Right. Yeah, I would definitely say that also stuff like, you know, Apollo 13, The Martian, even Apollo 11, which is the documentary that's all using archival footage of the Apollo 11 mission. There's a lot here to like that, if you like that kind of thing, if you like, you know, to know what's it like to be inside a rocket and, you know, what's it like to be in a jet and that kind of stuff. And of course, you know, if you're a man in the scientists and you'd like to get a perspective other than your own, this is also a good choice. I echo the Hidden Figures angle. She mentions it in the historical note, I think, or maybe just in the acknowledgements. And she, of course, recommends the book more than the movie because the movie kind of is a little white savior-y.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that. That makes sense.
One of the comps that I'm going to put in here that I think might sound strange, but A League of Their Own, because that it has some of the angle in there that the book has about, well, are these women being chosen as astronaut candidates just for the optics of the thing, or are they really being considered as worthy on their own? And yeah, that movie definitely has some of that in there about the, you know, well, this is just until the men get back from the war, and they kind of have to have a champion in there to say, no, this is a good thing that we have. This is where I usually would put a mini rant about why softball is a thing and why baseball isn't a viable option for women. I don't understand that. I love baseball, and I'd love to see a woman break into the majors. There was a young girl in Japan who is a knuckleballer, a sidearm knuckleballer. Her name is Eri Yoshida, and she actually played some professional ball in the United States, just at lower levels. But yeah, I'd love to see that happen. That'd be cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not sure there's much more we want to go over in non-spoiler talk. So how about we just move straight into spoilers?
Sure.
Okay. So in this section, it's just, we don't have to do a plot walkthrough, just whatever stood out to you as something that you want to talk about, highlights, lowlights, themes, whatever. Fire away.
I guess for me, the immediate thing that jumps out, especially on a reread, is just, I love the first line. Do you remember where you were when the meteor hit? And I like that for a couple of reasons. One, it kind of introduces the fundamental problem the characters have to overcome right in the very first line, and ties it to the reader's own experience with global tragedy. I know, at least for me, it conjured up memories of stepping off the school bus as a kid and learning about 9/11 and the World Trade Center for the first time. So I remember exactly where I was, and I can identify with that feeling immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And on a reread, it's kind of a big deal to have such a scientific narrator like Elma calling the meteorite a meteor, because that kind of shows how it's the public perception of everything and the optics of, well, meteor just kind of sounds more intimidating than meteorite.
It does. Yeah. The thing about knowing where you are, of course, every generation kind of has their own thing. Like my mom's generation, it was the assassination of Kennedy. And for me, it's more the Challenger disaster, because I was in junior high at that point when that happened. And of course, I also remember 9/11 because my son was tiny.
Yeah.
And obviously we have to talk about the sexism portrayed here. And I think I've seen that some people criticize it and say, oh yeah, we get it. Men are terrible. Men in the sciences are terrible. But the point is here, of course, this is set in the 50s, and that kind of casual sexism, blatant sexism really was more acceptable then. But I think if people want to say that that's completely gone away, they're fooling themselves.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think that's probably a criticism I don't understand of the book.
Yeah.
Just because that kind of seems to be one of the main points. I mean, that's the whole reason why they're named lady astronauts instead of just astronauts in the first place, is that sexism. Mm-hmm. They're trying to set them apart from the men who are going into space. So that's kind of one of the key problems, especially when you consider it's things like sexism and racism and just all of this bigotry that's holding humanity in the book back from actually surviving and getting off the planet before the oceans start to literally boil.
Yeah. At my work, at one time, my team was about 50% female. And I've absolutely seen some of the stuff portrayed in this book, even today, where I was in a meeting once with one of my colleagues, and she objected to something and said that it was stupid, and she was absolutely right. And the guy who she objected to went to our boss and wanted to write her up for, I can't even remember what the term was, but it was basically for her attitude. And so we had to go and talk to him and explain exactly what had happened. And fortunately, you know, he agreed with us that if a man had said what she said, she'd have been just thought of as a straight shooter who tells it like it is. But that guy didn't want to hear that from a woman. And you'd like to think that wouldn't be the way things would be anymore, but it is.
Yeah. And I guess, again, with the elephant in the room, as two men talking about this, it's probably easier for people like us to kind of brush that off and be like, oh, you know, we've come so much further since the 50s or whatever. It's not really an issue anymore. But no, this is kind of the lived reality of a lot of people today.
It is, yeah. And so I think it's important. It's incumbent on men who read something like this to not just go, well, that doesn't apply to me. I mean, there can be some introspection and go, do I have any of those attitudes that are deep ingrained in me from my upbringing, you know, or from my history? I mean, I'm obviously older than you are. But yeah, I like to think that I don't. You know, it's good to be introspective.
Yeah, absolutely. We all have internalized biases, and it's kind of inherently difficult for us to recognize that. So that's one of the things I like about science fiction and fantasy in general, is that it kind of lets you step outside of that and sort of see a different angle on things that you might see in the real world.
Yeah. For me, the fact of the marketing of the lady astronauts, you know, the astronets, as they call them at some point, on one hand, I go, okay, come on, we can do better than that. On the other hand, I totally get why they would want to do that, because they're wanting to make it a story, right? They're wanting to put excitement out there. But it's so exploitative the way they do it, you know, making them do the dunk test in a bikini, you know, that it's ridiculous.
Yeah. And that was actually a scene that I wanted to mention, because, I mean, Elma goes through it brilliantly. People are even saying when she comes up, like, oh, is that a new record? And the person who's like helping her set up for the dunk test is like, oh, wait, you want to actually do this for real? Like, your job is just to go down there and hold your breath until one of the men can save you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the kind of casual sexism of not expecting the same out of a woman that you would expect out of a man.
Right.
Which sucks.
Yeah. I think, I guess on a broader level, one of the things that's kind of interestingly timely about reading this book now is seeing how many people refuse to listen to science and are actively hamstringing the efforts to survive a global disaster. So they're like, oh, well, you know, I guess on the two levels, so climate change and the global pandemic, we're kind of feeling that just on accelerated scale in this book for climate change. People are saying, oh, well, it's comfortable outside, right? Like, we just had a winter. What do you mean it's going to get hotter? Like, we're good as we are right now.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, it's depressing how accurate that is. Science denial is not something that's new. It didn't come, you know, it didn't go away in the 50s and 60s. It's still with us.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm just going to say, at least in the face of all of, showing how awful people can be in this book, I did also like the light that kind of balanced that out. It was nice to see such a healthy and wholesome relationship between Elma and her husband. I feel like that stood out to me as being unusual. And the fact that it stood out to me as well, because I feel like that shouldn't be such a rare thing to see in fiction.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's lots of bad husbands out there, but certainly Nathaniel is presented as being a good one, one of the good ones. And yeah, it's the kind of thing where he's obviously super proud of her and excited for her. And that's good. I like to see that portrayed as well. The mental health angle is another interesting thing, because Elma has this almost crippling anxiety and kind of stage fright that some would say it keeps her from being a Mary Sue, being too perfect. Although, to be honest, the label Mary Sue is like a total man thing to label.
Yep.
because we don't really talk about it when it's a male character. There's plenty of male characters who are too perfect.
Yeah, I've heard the whole Gary Stew, but even that, like, no one actually uses that term.
Right. Or Marty Stew. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we don't really get that. But the anxiety thing is interesting, and just like the stigma of needing therapy or medication to make it, to dull it, right? To let her function.
Right. And I guess that stigma is still something we see today, hopefully to a lesser extent, but not all that much of a lesser extent, I think, unfortunately. I really liked that it was explicitly said in the book that if you had any other medical condition other than something mental health related, you would not hesitate to go to your doctor and get medication and do whatever treatment they thought was necessary.
Yep. Yeah. And this is one of the ones where when I look into myself and think about my internalized biases, I have to admit, you know, I'm a person who's always been very even keel. And so I have looked at people in the past, you know, a friend of mine who might be depressed more than I might be. And I think, well, why would that be? What are you weak? And that's not fair. It's not fair of me to think that way. Just because I don't have that affliction doesn't mean it's not real.
Right. It's very hard to step outside of ourselves, especially for something mental where you can't always like visibly see like, oh, this is what's going on. It's just reflected from an outsider's perspective in their actions and the quiet parts of their life that you can't see.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is that men are terrible about this kind of thing, picking on any weakness, any perceived weakness, and seeing it as a character flaw, when in fact it could be miswiring in somebody's brain that just can be corrected with a chemical. And, you know, we should be cool with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Very strong proponent of mental health and people getting the treatment they need for that.
Yeah. Yeah, very much. And that's, like I said, that's something that I've come around to because I recognize that in myself. The way Elma was treated in college is also mentioned as something that's important to how she's now treated in her present, right? Where this is another thing that men do, right? They're like, oh, are you going to let this girl beat you at the calculations?
Which is really unfair to Elma. And at the same time, even Elma herself admits like they did it because it works. Like the other men in her classes like worked harder because of that. Like they refused to let this woman show them up.
Yeah. It reminded me a little bit of Ender's Game when they're on the shuttle going up to battle school and Graf decides to label Ender as the best, you know, and to basically put a target on him.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a bullying thing.
Yeah, it really is. I guess maybe the idea is, oh, the person that you're putting this target on, it'll toughen them up as well, but it also motivates everyone else. I guess, maybe the slight difference there between Ender and Elma is that I doubt that her college professors were putting that target on her to help her at all.
Right. Yeah. No, they were trying to motivate the other people. And, you know, to be honest, it's the kind of experience that anyone who's kind of a prodigy goes through, you know, not just because she's female, but there's that additional angle of the sexism.
Right. Yeah. And the prodigy angle was an interesting one as well, because, I know the author has talked about this before, but it's almost like she uses math as her own little science fiction version of a magic system, where she's like, okay, there's this ridiculously out there problem. Just throw some math at it and you can probably solve it, which to a certain extent would work in the real world. If you are that brilliant at math, there's so many problems that it can solve. But it's almost like as the reader, you don't really have to understand how it works. You just have to know that Elma is a math genius and she can calculate her way out of just about any problem.
Well, and math is her happy place too, right? It's her place of comfort. And so I did like that when she was finally on the, in the rocket getting ready to go up, that Stetson Parker, who we do need to talk about, says, the engineering desk tells you to remember primes or to think about primes.
Yes.
Which I thought, you know, that's another good husband moment, right? Where, hey, she might need this right now.
Yeah. But since you've mentioned it, we definitely need to talk about Stetson Parker, because he is kind of the human face on all of the sort of social issues that Elma has to battle in order to get humanity off the planet and also kind of push back against the racism, the sexism, and everything that we're experiencing on the planet.
Yeah, he's just an ass. I mean, not just that. You can be an ass and still be, you know, you can be a more decent person than he is. And, you know, he's kind of looking out for himself. He still wants his own prestige. And that's why, you know, you come down to the plot of him hiding his injury.
Yes, which is incredibly hypocritical from his perspective, because he holds Elma's medication over her head, but he asked the same from her with, hey, don't give me away for my injury, which could prevent me from functioning completely instead of just dulling my senses slightly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, he does kind of, he, like you said, that's a good way to put it. The human face of all of that systemic negativity. But I mean, they don't really give him an out, because part of the reason for his antipathy is that she was somebody who stood up to his, harassment when they were in the military. And so he's angry about that. But of course, he has no right to be angry about that. But he doesn't think he did anything wrong.
Right. Yeah. There was that one moment where he was telling her, like, they tried to court-martial me. What did you think would happen? When they interviewed all the female pilots, none of them had any issues with me, which, I mean,
right.
What were they supposed to say at that point, right?
Right. What was the power dynamic? This is important. I like there's kind of a moment where Elma has this crushing realization that they may not even be intending to put women into space, and they may just be doing it as window dressing.
Right. And that's sort of the challenge every single step of the way. First, it was, you know, women just can't go into space. There's no way they're not suited for it. It's too dangerous. Despite the fact that the end goal of the program is to have a colony in space, which, as Elma repeatedly says, you're going to need women if you want children to be born in space. And from then it's, oh, like, yes, you have all this piloting experience, but you weren't real pilots. And then, okay, right. Well, maybe we need to at least pretend that they're going to be astronauts, but we're going to call them astronauts. We're going to call them lady astronauts. We're going to stick them in bikinis and have them go through the motions of the actual training. So every step of the way, they're pushing back against actually doing it.
Yeah, we're going to have them sit in the cockpit of a jet and powder their nose.
Yeah.
There's definitely something like that in A League of Their Own, where somebody like slides into home base and then gets up and readjusts her makeup for the cameras.
Yeah, I definitely need to check out that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a good movie. It's not about space. So there. This book has a lot of very cinematic moments, and I'm shocked, actually, that we haven't heard about an adaptation. Maybe I just have not been looking in the right place. But you have the disaster at the air show with the birds. You even have, the meteor strike and that flight and the unpowered landing and that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I am not typically a very visual person when I'm reading, but that whole opening scene with the meteor hitting, and then you have these two brilliant scientific minds that are like, okay, we know what's coming next, because there's only one thing that could have like been that bright and that loud from so far away. And so they're like knowing, okay, right. First comes like, the tremors, then comes like the air shock and all of that. And so they're preparing. So we kind of get to prepare ourselves mentally for that when it's happening. But I'm just picturing this movie in my mind, like this disaster scene where the inevitable is happening and it's terrible, but you can't stop it. You've got 5 minutes to prepare. What do you do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's like, people being on a beach when a tsunami is about to come in and the water starts rushing out, you know, the smart people are going to notice that and go, oh, this is bad. This is real bad.
Yep.
My little sister Katie was actually in Japan, and her town was at where she was staying. She was teaching English, was just destroyed by the tsunami. And we were worried, you know, did she get warned in time? Cause we didn't hear from her for a few days. But she heard she felt the earthquake. And since we grew up in Alaska, we're used to what a normal garden variety earthquake feels like. And she was like, nope, this one's different. And then the tsunami warning horns started going off, sirens started going off, and she went, okay, up the hill and bugged out. And it was a good thing she did.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine what it would be like to go through something like that in the moment.
Mm-mm. Yeah. She said you can't imagine the sound. I can't even describe it. Let's see. I feel like we didn't dwell very long on Stetson Parker.
No, we didn't, but, which is kind of a shame, because he really is like the fundamental, I guess, antagonistic force of this book.
Yeah.
And the frustrating thing too is, right, like everyone else sees Parker as this like model human being, the first man in space, like so charismatic, so charming. And we see everything else. So when he lets that mask slip, like he's just terrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, he announces his intention to try to keep her grounded. And when she's announced that she's going to be in the command module, he very much argues against it. And I like the fact that, what was the name of the director? I can't remember what his name was. But he recognizes it. This is a personal vendetta here. You know, we're choosing the right person for the job. And I like that everybody else around the table stood up for her too and said, because he brings up the, what's it called? Milltown?
Yeah. Milltown.
The medication and everybody else is like, that situation that happened with the door seal, you don't think that was a high pressure situation? And she was perfect in that situation.
Yeah. They even say like, if that was her, like with dulled senses, like I'm afraid to see what she would be like at full function, because that was amazing.
Yeah. 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 And that's another really cinematic scene that I think would be great on film.
And even just kind of the emotional aftermath of that, where everyone stands up for her, but at the same time, like, she realizes Parker's going to go to the media. He's going to turn the media against her, which, yeah, given how prominent public perception and PR and media has been in the entire story so far, like, that's a very, very real threat, especially since that's kind of her main fear, is the media and public attention and everything on her. So that's like, mm-hmm, especially like, oh no. And so that's kind of feels like the culminating, like, big climax, even in a book that's all about going to space and about these rocket launches, like, just that social situation at the end, where is her friend going to write an article about the Milltown? That was really interesting to me, because it really kind of hammers home a lot of it's about the human side of things. It's not just about getting off the planet. It's, what do you do to get there? How do you go about doing that? And so I thought that was a really powerful moment at the end, when eventually she was like, you know what? I'm not going to stoop to Parker's level. Like, I could, but I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to lose who I am to get off the planet.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That is a good moment. It's a good way to kind of wrap things up. I like the fact that, because at first I was thinking, I expected the plot to get farther in terms of getting Elma into space. And, but I don't know, once I finished, I thought, okay, that was the perfect place to end the first book.
Right. Yeah. And I guess a minor quibble I have is that the book is called The Calculating Stars. And so on the one hand, it's the star women behind the scenes who are like the human calculators, but also we don't realize that, like, visually in their world, the stars have been obscured with all of the water and debris and dust that's been kicked up into the atmosphere, which is accelerating the greenhouse effect. Like, they literally cannot see the stars. And so that's kind of a beautiful moment at the end as well, where she can see the stars again.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. I was wondering, as I was reading this, I thought, was there any discussion about, methods for trying to overcome the greenhouse effect by essentially, like, putting dust in the atmosphere to try to essentially keep that winter going long enough for the water vapor to disperse? But this is also in the 50s, right? It's not like current technology that we have now.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm not even sure how we do that now. Right. I mean, was it Elon Musk who was saying we should blow up a bunch of nukes on Mars to try to cause a greenhouse effect there?
That seems like something he would say. Yeah.
Yeah. That strikes me as not a terrific idea.
No, anything involving a large number of nukes, I'm kind of instinctively against.
Yeah. Have you read further in the series?
I have, yes. So I haven't read the most recent book that just released, The Relentless Moon, okay, but I have read the second book.
Okay. The Fated Sky.
Yes, that's the one.
Okay. So, recommendation?
As to whether I would recommend it or not?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I think if you enjoyed The Calculating Stars, The Fated Sky is going to deliver as well. It's definitely, okay. I mean, we're picking up, there's a little bit of a time skip, so you're a little bit in the future from book one. But I mean, book one has time skips all over the place. Between chapters, yeah, you're like, okay, it's 4 years later. We're past the whole winter stage, and now we're getting into the heating up. So there's an element of that as well. And it is more focused on, okay, we've already got off planet in book one. Like, what's next? Do we do the moon base? Do we go to Mars? How do we do all these things? And I think the interpersonal dynamics are there as well. And Stetson Parker is still a terrible person and still probably the main okay. villain.
All right. I was kind of hoping. I thought, I was predicting at the end she was going to get up into space and Parker back in Kansas, not Houston, was going to say, congratulations, you're now officially an astronaut. But instead it was, one of the nicer people who was in the actual ship with her.
Right. And I guess, so on the note of Parker, that's kind of one thing I'm a little conflicted on, because I get why it's done and it's probably more realistic, but there's a lot of things to sort of like about Parker as well. Maybe not a lot of things, but there are things to like about him. Like, Elma continually acknowledges when he's teaching, he's great. He's a great teacher. He's very patient. He's very understanding. He genuinely wants you to learn as much as possible. And he actually has the best interests from his perspective of the space program in mind. He wants humans to get to the moon, to Mars. He wants to get into space.
Right.
And so there is more exploration of that in book two. But it's interesting because he is not 100% terrible. I would say he's like 98% terrible, but <Right. laughs> the 2% redeeming qualities are what everyone else sees. And I don't think it's enough to outweigh how he is to Elma, how he is to everyone else.
Mm-hmm. Does the second book go into anything about his wife?
Yes, it does. There's, okay. And as rereading book one, there's a lot of groundwork laid for that. Just in mm-hmm. offhand comments and wording that Mary Robinette chooses to use. And I think that's probably one of the more divisive natures of book two is how Parker's okay. wife is handled.
Okay. I have the book. I just haven't read it yet. So, but I'm going to be on an airplane tomorrow, so I might read it.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely recommend it. I loved it. It's one of the few series where the first time I was reading it through, I put down book one and immediately picked up book two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My copy of The Calculating Stars had the preview chapter of the next book. And I'm like, nope. I got other stuff I got to do. I can't start reading this right
yes,
now.
Yes. I fervently avoid preview chapters for upcoming books.
Yeah. Therein lies madness. I mean, I do like to wait for books to come out on deals, you know, on eBooks especially. And so I was really happy that The Faded Sky was actually cheap in the lead up to the release of The Relentless Moon. So now I have both of those. I have the first two books, so I'll get the third one eventually.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. When I can, I try to get everything on deals, which leads to yeah. buying lots of books years before I actually read them, which, you know,
right. okay,
maybe a good thing, maybe a bad thing.
I'm glad to hear that there's somebody else who does that. I have a friend who, you know, will buy the same books and he'll read them almost immediately. Of course, he reads a lot faster than I do. But I'm always like, nope, that was another one of those. Seth buys it and lets it sit on his Nook for a while.
Yep.
Sometimes years. So
those 99-cent to like $3 price range deals, those are what really hurt my wallet way more than full price books.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's only a couple bucks. You know, I can buy that.
I'll get to it eventually. I bought full series of like 10 plus books that way before. Because I'm like, I know I'll get to it eventually.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Although, yeah, I know myself now that I'm a good series starter and I'm pretty good at reading the first book and then being like, you know, maybe I'll do it sometime, but I'm not real excited about reading entire series.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. So, I read way more broadly than I read deeply for just about anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then for me, you know, having two podcasts where I have to read books, it makes it so that my extracurricular reading is locked down pretty well. I'm glad that my next title for this is a reread for the main Hugo show is a reread, and so I'm doing it on audio. So that means in the meantime, I can read whatever I want, which is awesome.
Yeah, that's a nice feeling. It's very freeing, especially when so much of your reading list is locked down for other commitments.
Yeah. Well, other topics you want to discuss?
I'm scrolling through the notes that I have. Let's see. I guess one thing that I really enjoyed as well is showing that even how in the overall thrust, like we're facing a mass extinction event, we're advancing the space program. There's all of these major issues to overcome. Life still goes on though. Right. So like right. there's big sub, well, maybe not big subplots, but like she's going to her nephew's bar mitzvah. And mm-hmm. like her relationship with her brother outside of anything scientific or saving the world. I really like that.
Yeah.
Because I mean, that's important, right? Life doesn't go on complete pause and you either save the world or everyone dies. Like it still continues in the interim.
Yeah. Yeah. The family relationships are very sweet. It's very touching when she found out that her aunt was still alive.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess on that note, like I thought it was interesting how just acceptable social behavior shifted with the meteorite landing. So like, and she even has this moment where in small talk, like no one asks about each other's family anymore because so many people had someone right. die that it's just like mm-hmm. not what you do.
Yep. A shared experience. I also really enjoyed that Elma and Nathaniel had a healthy sex life and they used astronaut terminology sometimes. Oh, we are go for lunch.
Sometimes they used it a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot.
But yeah, and I think, so Mary Robinette's mentioned before that people have complained about how prominent their sex life is, even though it's fade to black every time, and it's something right. like three explicit scenes over the course of 5 or 6 years in the timeline. So that's not like all that big of an emphasis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like it's tastefully done.
Yeah, absolutely. And just the whole relationship between Elma and Nathaniel again, like I really loved that. And some people would say, oh, well, you know, she's married to sleeping with like the head of the program or whatever. Of course she has like everything going her way, but we see like that doesn't help her out nearly as much as you would think. Right. Like there's only so much he can do.
Yeah. They're very conscious of it as well. Like the way they behave around each other at work.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's anything else we need to cover. How about you? Any other thoughts?
No, it's a high recommend for me. I really enjoyed it. And I definitely will read the rest of the series, but, I might only do episodes on those for patrons. So
yeah. Yep. Who knows, maybe a future book will win the Hugo as well.
Yeah, that is possible. So, final thoughts from you.
I guess echoing what you said, I really love this book. This is a strong recommendation from me. I like to the extent that I know that The Relentless Moon, which I have not read yet, will be a very enjoyable read as well. Without even picking it up yet, like I know I'm going to love it. So yeah, a high recommendation.
Cool. All right. Well, I also recommend, of course, the Lady Astronaut of Mars story, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes if anybody else wants to read it. And my friend Colin told me that there are some connected short stories as well to this book.
Okay. Yeah. I was actually unaware of that. I knew the original story, but I didn't know there were others. So I'll have to look those up.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to have to do that as well. All right. Well, before we sign off, why don't you tell people where they can find you?
All right. Yeah. So you can find me at thefantasyinn.com or just search for the Fantasy Inn podcast wherever you normally listen to podcasts. I think we're pretty much everywhere. And even though I'm more of a fantasy fan than science fiction, there's quite a few interviews in there with sci-fi authors and podcasters as well.
Cool. And this is a podcast you do with a couple other people.
Yes. Yeah. So we're split between the other bloggers at the Fantasy Inn. We'll have discussion episodes on different topics. So we'll talk about a specific subgenre. We'll talk about how people use social media to promote books. We'll talk about kind of anything that goes through our heads at the moment. And then we'll alternate those with discussion panels. So we'll talk about like an artist and an author, how they collaborate on coming up with a book cover. We'll talk about topics like how different authors approach world building. And we'll also have those long form, about an hour long each, interviews.
Okay, cool. Well, that's something new for me to check out as well. Well, Travis, I really want to thank you for doing this. Thank you for reaching out. This is another success story of my contact form.
Yep.
How did you find the podcast, by the way?
I sort of obsessively look out any kind of science fiction and fantasy podcast I can find. So I know some people are like me and compulsively subscribe to podcasts. I think I have about 540-something subscriptions at the moment. A lot of those are nonfiction, science fiction, and fantasy related.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of do that as well. And anytime I find a new podcast, I subscribe to it. And then, you know, it's the kind of thing where if I see that, oh, there's 10 episodes that have built up there that I haven't listened to, I might go in and start weeding stuff out.
Yeah, I very much cherry pick. I won't listen to like a bunch of podcast episodes from the same in a row. I'll kind of like bounce around every single episode. Specifically, I think I found your podcast through a crossover episode with the Spectology podcast. I think that's how I originally found you.
Nice. I just recorded an episode of my Comfort Reads episodes with Adrian from Spectology. So
okay. Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Good guys. Oh, I was going to mention there was a recent article that I saw on Pocket about Wilhelmina Fleming, who worked in the Harvard computers in the late 19th century. And discovered the first white dwarf. But it was one of those situations where, maybe I'll put this in the postscript. It was one of those situations where the head of the Harvard computers said something like, well, you know, my maid could do this. It's so simple.
Oh, and, man.
So it was that kind of situation. And of course, she was brilliant. And so it turned out she could do it better. And she contributed in a big way to astronomy. So it's funny because there's so much of the history of science is, well, scientist is a gentleman's profession, you know, and so even somebody like Michael Faraday, who was a commoner, had a hard time getting published. He had to publish through lesser minds who happened to be, you know, born rich. And that combined with the sexism as well, there was lots of work that was done by women that was taken credit for by men.
Yeah, I feel like I'm constantly learning about sort of the unsung heroes of really lots of professions, unfortunately. They just kind of history overlooks.
Yeah. Well, even if you look at science fiction, you know, like we like to say that the history of golden age science fiction is entirely men writing, but it's just not the case. There were a lot of women who were writing. And for that, I recommend Lisa Jazyk's book, The Future is Female, where she talks about some of the big names in early science fiction that were female that we'd forgotten.
Yeah, I'm actually reading through, there's an anthology put out, I think, by Gideon Marcus, where it's all focused on, it's called Rediscovery, I think. It's all focused on mm-hmm. science fiction women writers from like a 5-year range, like the late 50s, early 60s, a bunch of their short stories. So it's really fascinating, like the quality of work that was being put out by people you've just never heard of before.
Yep. Unfortunately, there's a survivorship bias, and we only see what survives, and sometimes it only survives because of biases.
Yep. Yeah, I'm staunchly opposed to the idea that quality is the only thing you need and that meritocracy works in just about anything.
All right. Well, thanks again. I'm sure we'll interact down the line.
Yeah.
And take care.
Yeah. You too, Seth.
Okay, bye. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Travis. And I definitely recommend you check out The Fantasy Anne. I'll put all the links to that in the show notes. And, you know, a book like this, like I mentioned earlier, if you want to get other perspectives on it, I totally get that. And I do highly recommend the Hugo Girl podcast. They do a tremendous job over there. They cover a lot of stuff that I don't even think to cover. And so I'm glad that they're out there doing that, because it makes it so it's a fun listen for me as well. So if you're enjoying this podcast and you want to support it in any way, I invite you to do so. If you'd like to retweet the episodes, that's fantastic. If you want to follow me on social media, it's at Hugo's Podcast. If you want to guest on the show, if you have somebody else who you think should guest on the show, drop me a line, feedback@hugospodcast.com, or fill out the contact form on the website. And if you'd like to support this podcast and my other podcasts financially, you can do that patreon.com/hugospodcast. I have gotten to the point where I'm starting to do patron-only content. So if you want access to that, then you can get access to it for as little as $1 a month. And I think that'll do it for this time. I will, of course, have another Comfort Reads episode coming out in the middle of September. And that one's with my sister Megan. So that was fun. And I have a lot of guests for that. But if you want a guest on the Comfort Reads, you can also reach out to me. Okay, that'll do it. Talk to you next time. Bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.
And we are going to be discussing the calculating scars. Sorry.